And here's a quick rundown of what I want to talk about today. So I'll start by sort of making a case for why studying the politics of diaspora engagement is important, and give a little bit of an overview of what I mean. I'll then look at what the existing literature says, specifically in the fields of IR and political geography, because I think that they are engaging with what I'm really trying to get at. I will then, of course, introduce my specific project and some important building blocks, some conceptual issues, and then I will hopefully spend the bulk of the talk talking about sort of preliminary findings and also the data that I've collected. And let me delve right into some of my field data, so to speak. So last summer, when I was conducting fieldwork in Toronto, I attended the annual general meeting of the Ontario Council for International Cooperation, which also simultaneously functioned as a symposium and a bunch of workshops on innovation for development, and the title was Innovation Ignites. So the OCIC is the provincial arm of the Canadian Council for International Cooperation, which is tasked with strengthening the development NGO capacity, development NGO capacity in line with Canadian foreign policy goals, and as of 2015, with an explicit focus on the sustainable development goals. One of the agenda items at the AGM was the ratification of new members, and this included last summer, one small diaspora-run organization founded in 2014 by a small group of young professional Canadian Tamils. Now, this group has made a comparatively big splash in Toronto's development community, although reception from within the Tamil diaspora has been mixed at best. Their mission has been to profoundly shift basically the mobilization of the Canada-based Tamil diaspora towards Sri Lanka, and they have been emphasizing the need for development in the north and east part of the island. And this group has also been part of an informal diaspora engagement networking group, which is the actual name. And this networking group is part of OCIC endeavors, and it's existed for 2 years. I actually was there at the initial meeting in the summer of 2016, just when I started my fieldwork. And this is sort of led by the OCIC and part of their mandate to build capacity of specifically diaspora-run development organizations. And so far, they've organized workshops on, for example, how to apply for grants from Global Affairs Canada, and they've conducted surveys across Ontario on which diaspora-run or diaspora-led or diaspora-focused organizations already exist. This event, so the AGM, but also the networking group, are not epiphenomenal. Overall, we know that there has been an increase in states with diaspora engagement institutions. This is something that Harris has worked on. But besides states, non-state actors like the World Bank here in DC, the African Union, think tanks and NGOs, which overall I sort of define and conceptualize as global governance actors, are also beginning to engage diasporas. But I think that with this globalizing of diaspora engagement, there comes also a tendency to depoliticize and to frame diaspora engagement as a management tool or an operational strategy. But of course, diaspora engagement is rife with politics. Each time one of these global governance actors decides to include diasporas as part of a partnership project in development or a stakeholder, another is by default excluded. And this has consequences for the diaspora, of course, but also for questions such as which diaspora ends up being engaged, and then therefore what development practice is encouraged, and overall also what kind of order is being reproduced is affected by this. And so some existing scholarship, or there are a few literature strands that have something to say about why diaspora engagement for development might be increasing, and arguments that people here in DC might be familiar with, specifically here at the Elliott School, is that diaspora contribute positively to international development, for example, by sending remittances or by being entrepreneurs. And the takeaway here in this sort of argument is that diaspora engagement is desirable, but effectively this literature isn't actually concerned with explaining the rise of institutions or initiatives like what I'm trying to do, but I thought that people here would maybe expect me to touch upon this. However, scholars that have addressed diaspora engagement through institutions, policies, and initiatives more explicitly have argued the following. Either diaspora engagement, and I'm really broadly paraphrasing here, is part of a nation-building project, which Harris discussed in his 2012 book. Alan Gamlin has argued that diaspora engagement is part of an emerging global migration governance regime. And these first two arguments are sort of about state interests in managing their own populations. But then there's also kind of a more critical literature that draws inspiration from Foucauldian neo-Marxist theory that suggests that diaspora engagement benefits primarily powerful Western states, either by furthering capitalist expansion, by acting as a form of neoliberal governmentality, or by producing a liberal global order. Now, I find a lot of value in all of these accounts, and I will be using, of course, what they've found in my research, but I also think, or will argue, that they miss a whole big part of the story of politics of diaspora engagement. First of all, they remain state-centric, and if they sort of look at the global politics or global governance, then they still sort of focus on structural developments or suggest that diaspora engagement is driven by a single universal logic, be it political or managerial. And that means that they're unable to visualize, let alone theorize, events such as the one outlined above. The thing is, I would argue that this is really the stuff that diaspora engagement and migration governance more widely is made of. Migration, mobility, and diaspora are messy phenomena that exist through the trespassing of borders by bodies, through the creation of networks between cities, so essentially the spaces in between states. And so the engagement and the governance of diasporas is no different. Yes, there might be bilateral agreements and global compacts, but even these institutions and measures have become sensitive to the fact that it is notoriously difficult to manage mobility and migration from a top-down state-based level. And accordingly, diaspora engagers, both state and non-state, have diversified their governance toolbox to operate transnationally and to engage with subnational networks. So, as scholars of such transnational or subnational governance, we also need to step up our conceptual and methodological game, is what I suggest. And I'm not saying that we need to think exactly like these actors, but we need to sort of meet them where they are and to see actually what their realities look like. And I suggest that, or I hope that my project will do this. So my dissertation tries to shed light on the politics of diaspora engagement by taking into account the things that other theories don't even see. For example, how the global is located in the local, and how both agents and structures constitute global politics. Important, of course, the conceptual building blocks that will allow me to do this. So I asked sort of how do we study, in Harris and Alexandra's words, the micro-foundations of diaspora politics. First of all, I think we need to take practices seriously. I use them as my unit of analysis through which we can observe local embodiment of global dynamics. And I suggest that we should situate these practices in assemblages as a level of analysis that is different from the state. I take a Bourdieusian perspective on practices, which means that practices exist in a field of power and are imbued with different forms of capital, that's social, economic, and cultural. And the hierarchical distribution of capital is what structures a field of power, what you could call a governance logic. And I operationalize this field of power, or domain, as it's been called in other areas of the social science, as the assemblage. So assemblages contain essentially the history and background knowledge in front of which the practices unfold, but they are not equivalent to a national field. Rather, an assemblage is an emergent and abductively generated frame of reference. And this will come out, I hope, in the writing and in one of the slides that's coming up. So my working hypothesis for my overall thesis at the moment is that there is not one overarching structural logic driving diaspora engagement, rather that these logics are context or assemblage specific. So in order to argue that diaspora engagement is context specific, I chose to study three sites in depth, and my cases essentially are cities that sit at the intersection of global governance fields and Tamil diaspora engagement. And in my thesis, I tell three different stories of diaspora engagement. One of Tamil diaspora engagement in development in Toronto, which is what I will focus on today. One of Tamil diaspora engagement in transitional justice in Geneva, and one of Tamil diaspora engagement in security governance in London. And in true Bourdieusian fashion, I used multiple data generation methods, and I spent approximately 1.5 years doing field work, although of course I chose London as one of my sites, which is also my hometown, but the intricacies of this are complex and have been discussed by anthropologists. I conducted over 30 interviews, and it's kind of still ongoing, and then I engaged sort of in countless hours of observation of conferences and workshops, but also of online webinars, and traipsed through online archives and communications material, because most of what I'm looking at is digital these days, which also means that I can conduct research wherever I find myself. So a combination of the data that my fieldwork generated has and will help me through three analytical steps that are not kind of, chronologically distinct, but sort of iterative. And so I started by abductively tracing an outline of an assemblage through social network analysis and discourse analysis, and also through the interviews that I conducted in the field. I then reconstruct the dispositional logic, or the hierarchy of practices that I talked about, and then finally I studied the embodied practices as they unfolded in space through participant observation and ethnographic interviews. We'll get to the good stuff. The way that I've chosen to represent the assemblage in this presentation is necessarily different from what I will be able to present in written form in my thesis. The idea in my thesis is to weave a story from disparate threads and jumping across time scales and space through a mix of genealogy and process tracing. And I hope to come up sort of with a story that a story that weaves together, again, different threads, and this will be a story of changes in the global political economy of the last 30 years, institutional drivers and critical junctures, a story of UN initiatives to foster development with the help of non-state actors, a story of events that start to link migrants to development, a story of how diaspora engagement in development is formalized by the US State Department into the International Diaspora Engagement Alliance, so right here in DC, and then the spillover of these institutions via elite political networks to Canada. And then we also have the shift from conservative to liberal leadership of Canada, and shifting perceptions of Canada's role in the world, no least also because of the election of Trump here. And then the initiation of the Sustainable Development Goals and local interpretations by civil society networks in Toronto. What I also will be talking about or writing about will be the urban and suburban realities of life in Toronto, and weaving through all of this the experience of Tamil diaspora in Toronto, including intra-Tamil diaspora rifts during the Civil War and the redistribution of power among diaspora subgroups in the post-Civil War period. And in visual form, the assemblage can be imagined something like this, and I'll read it to you. Toronto, a city where those with diverse roots can grow and intermingle into a complex and exciting multicultural garden. This is a subway station near Scarborough, where most of the Tamils actually live in the greater Toronto area. So I start with this, and then kind of bring together some supranational, some state actors, some sub-state or state-related actors, private companies and civil society, Tamil diaspora organizations, and then spaces and occasions where these different actors and spaces mesh. Oh, sorry, someone just tried to get in.
Come on in.
Anyway. The work that this slide is supposed to do is to visually represent the assembling of the assemblage. So to bring together the constitutive actors, organizations, and places, but also to create a visual image of the background in front of which the practices, which I will talk about now, play out. So with this assemblage in mind, I will now do two things. I will map the practices that structure the assemblage and then offer some preliminary thoughts on how these practices are informed by different types of capital. And I hope to tease out what hierarchization of capital might mean for who does diaspora engagement and development actually end up engaging and who is excluded by diaspora engagement. So what kind of practices should we look at to see who is embraced and who is left out of diaspora engagement for development? I suggest that we should be considering, of course, the diaspora's practices, but we also need to open up the black box of the engager or the sort of network of global governance actors who are tasked with the engagement. And then finally, but no less importantly, the spatial embeddedness of both the diaspora and the networks of engagers. So this will sort of be the tripartite setup of me presenting my practices, my data to you. And the first set of practices that I want to look at are those practices that are somewhat specific to the experience of the Tamil diaspora in Canada, and I sort of unpack this a little bit more in the paper, which I've printed out three more sections, but for now, let me basically talk you through a couple of the observations that are the practices. So on the one hand, we have those that I've clustered around the concept of the model migrant, which are reprimanding violence, engaging in dialogue, uttering moderate views, and so on. And then performing Canadian citizenship are different observations, such as upholding Canadian values of multiculturalism, feminism and diversity, bridging ethnic cleavages, and practicing Aboriginal solidarity, performing hyphenated Canadian citizenship. And then also part of Canadian citizenship is sort of this performance of global citizenship where invoking responsibility and the concept of global impact or eschewing nationalism are things that are quite prominent. So based on a more specific experience of ethnic Tamils in the Canadian national context, a tentative hierarchy of practices might look something like this. So we start in the top left corner with the practice or the of working towards a political goal, which in the assemblage of engaging diasporas for development isn't exactly the thing that you expect to find to be a successful practice. And then so it kind of goes down zigzags, working towards development, framing aims within development as ethnically specific or framing them as exclusive, then sort of being old, and I actually, mean in age and set in your ways to being young and innovative, all the way down to distinguishing between whether someone identifies as Tamil Canadian or Canadian Tamil, or in the end as a global citizen. But again, this is preliminary, changes might occur in the order here. But of course, so the point I want to make now is that the politics of diaspora engagement for development aren't just about a diaspora's positioning in a national context. Even if a member of a diaspora says and does all the right things, the conditions of possibility for engagement in development are shaped by more than the state diaspora relationship. And I've got here so basically what happens when we study up, when we open the black box of the global governance network. And here is the answer that I posed to one of the people in charge of organizing and overseeing a number of events that engage Tamil or diaspora more widely, but also the Tamil diaspora in development in Toronto. And I'll read it out. So I think we generated the list through the list of invitees through our own networks, and we also had a significant in-kind contribution from my former employer, which was the Ontario Ministry of Economic Development and Trade. They loaned us the Ontario Investment and Trade Centre, of which I had been the inaugural director, which is a beautiful international trade presentation centre on Yonge Street. So I think it might have been a bit quid pro quo in that they provided a lot of names to investors as well, which was great because they wanted to be seen as actively engaged in diaspora communities and conversations about business networks. So that worked for them. The peace building part worked for us, the development part worked for us and for CUSO International and for IDEA. And IDEA, the International Diaspora Engagement Alliance here in DC, was able to say, look, we have this partner event happening in Toronto that extends the region, the footprint of IDEA, but is organized through a particular Canadian lens. Everyone was happy. Evidently, when we consider this quote, what we see is that the importance of professional networking practices, the significance of the individual node to create and maintain these networks, as well as the ability to scale jump, use your position within the network, scale jump between sub-state and state level actors is important. So ultimately, practices that have less to do with what an organization or a diaspora individual is doing or saying in terms of diaspora engagement, but how they are doing it. So observations for these practices and this list, again, is not exhaustive for having and possessing, if you will, professional personal networks would include a social media presence, civil society networking groups, professional associations, diaspora networks, workshops and other events, and then practices or observations which are about sort of positioning oneself in the network, include the number of links or edges to use the network language, but I'm not so sure that I want to do that. The ability to leverage the network, for example, by linking different actors, and this could be part of what kind of job a person has, or what their career choice is, and how often they move around. And then building and maintaining networks is another cluster of practices where it's sort of about building relationships based on trust, partnership, and reciprocity are some of the words that are said or enacted that sort of structure the assemblage. And one of the things that I want to tease out later in my analysis, but I'll go into it a little bit here, is that in many ways diaspora are hailed as a crucial node in this global development network, and they also embody the network metaphor, which gives us sort of a taste of why global governance actors might be so excited about the whole concept. However, ultimately the emphasis on such networking practices is really quite stressful for people who have limited resources, like those working in the nonprofit sector, and also means that diaspora that are not part of already existing elite networks with high levels of professionalization stand little chance of entering. And so when we bring in Bourdieu, we understand that these practices are mostly, or these practices specifically, are driven by what he understands to be social capital. So in the development field, but also among global governance actors more widely, the invoking and performance of the importance of social capital is widespread. And it's kind of a deeply held belief by neoliberals, if not neoliberalism's founding myth, that social capital, for example, as social networks, trumps other forms of economic and cultural capital. Down the line, this now means that talking in the language of networks, talking about systems, talking about partnerships and trust, has, beyond being a social capital-endued practice, become a form of cultural capital, which then turns the liberal myth on its head, essentially. All this to basically say that we also need to look at cultural capital practices in the area of the level of the global governance actors. And so practices from cultural capital are still key to the persistence of governance networks and play a huge role in determining which actors and organizations make it into this network in the first place. So I have clustered my observations around some patterns that emerged from the data, but also practice categories that I've found in the literature. And on this slide, you have here the sustainable development goal perspective. And I realize these are quite, you know, crude categories, but I just wanted to give you a taste of what the practices are and not just put them, but structure them in some way. This is something that I'm working on and that I would love some feedback on. So part of the cultural capital imbued practices are invoking SDGs, talking about going micro and going local, technical assistance, capacity building, but also acknowledging complexity and interdependence, thinking holistically, talking about responsibility, being responsible, and talking about values or enacting values and purpose. And then with beyond the kind of development-specific practices, I clustered it as good governance, which, you know, you could also talk about organizational culture, but again, this is something that I'm working on right now. So that would be invoking best practices or making best practices, performing democratic norms like transparency, accountability, participation, and public engagement. But also what I just said, talking about leveraging networks, that has become sort of a best practice in itself. And then some, again, concepts that this is sort of the cutting edge where I'm at now, are the practices that structure the assemblage, and I believe are really important, could be clustered around the concept of effective altruism, but this comes from sort of moral philosophy, so maybe I can find something better here, but basically what effective altruism, what it would be practiced through are practices like advocating for system change, philanthropic practices, emphasis on philosophy and morality, and invocations of selfless giving, which are really quite rife in the assemblage where diaspora engagement overlaps with the development field. And then something, again, that's sort of cutting edge in urban sociology, and I just found out a friend of mine is working with Mike Savage at LSE on this concept of emerging. She works on emerging cultural capital, he works on urban cultural capital. But without knowing about this literature, I clustered these practices that had something to do with basically existing in Toronto as a city in the 21st century. So this focus on educational attainment, emphasis on youth engagement, usage of youth jargon and millennialisms, highlighting innovation and newness, referencing popular culture, in this case, quoting Drake lyrics, for example, amongst the Tamil diaspora, performing wokeness, emphasizing reflexivity and spirituality. And so altogether, evidently, some of these overlap, and I still have, you know, to unpack my bulk of practices, and that's what I'm working on now. But I like sort of, you know, how we can actually see some overlapping stuff going on here, and I feel like this is really where the magic kind of cultural capital that I can maybe find sits. So, anyway, going to my third kind of cluster, or my third theme for this talk, is that emphasizing this idea that practices, neither of the diaspora nor of the engagement networks, flow freely. So even if a Tamil diaspora organization says all the right things and shows up on the radar of international development networks, this does not guarantee that they will be engaged. Other conditions must be met. Essentially, the practices of diaspora and the engagers are spatially anchored. And to show how, I want to talk a little bit about the Robertson Building. The building, this is a kind of cutout from the website where they describe themselves as a home to a cluster of community businesses, social entrepreneurs, and non-profit organizations, as well as by a wall, a completely living, breathing wall made of plants, an extensive green roof, greenhouse, and cedar viewing deck. So interestingly, approximately 30% of my fieldwork in Toronto took place in or in close proximity to the Robertson Building in downtown Toronto. The OCIC AGM, which I started my talk with, was held across the road and is essentially part of the same estate. Now, this restored warehouse contains the offices of the OCIC, the Ontario Council for International Cooperation, of CUSA International, and the Centre for Social Innovation, and thereby forms a crucial component in the Toronto Diaspora Engagement Assemblage. But what does it mean for the politics of diaspora engagement when a place like the Robertson Building forms the central location for all diaspora engagement and development activity in the Greater Toronto Area? And here I mostly have a bunch of questions that I still want to explore and to see how I maybe can use this this case or this institution to illustrate some things that I want to say in my thesis. So if we think of the Robertson Building as a symbolic institution, we could ask, is it a signifier of gentrification and neoliberal working culture that symbolically excludes the migrant working class? You see here the picture of the Bayeux Wall, and then this sort of post-industrial combination of oriental rugs and you know, high culture chandeliers, and then here's an image from Google Street View of the roof deck, which clearly shows that this building is prime property in Toronto. And then if we think of the Robertson Building as a social space, we could ask, well, is it really a hub, as it suggests, where anyone can mingle and where organizations share office space and create building networks? And I mean, I could, you know, talk you through all of these organizations that exist here, but this is just an illustration for now.